and he didn't have the strength for it. We need to do something, the old man said. You can't go through this every day. Milton tried to speak, but all he could manage was an uncontrollable cough.
What?
Milton waited until it subsided.
Got any ideas?
Not really. Milton managed to raise himself to a sitting position.
Fitz, he said. He said he was getting out.
You think that will make things better? Milton shook his head, but the movement was dizzying and it made him feel sick.
No, Isco said, finishing for him. I don't suppose it would. Message, he said.
What?
Need to get message out.
To who?
Manila, he said. Can you help?
Perhaps. I might be able to find an inmate who has a visitor. I am friendly with some. Perhaps they could arrange it.
Who do you need to speak to? Police, Milton said.
Chapter 44. Josie's mother didn't want her to go to work. She had to reassure her that it was the right thing to do, but the effort meant that she was half an hour late getting out the door. She had never driven in from Taguig before, and the traffic was terrible. It meant that she was 40 minutes late in getting to the station. She tried to hurry along the corridor to the desk, but she hadn't managed to get more than a handful of paces beyond Mendoza's open door when he called out to her.
Where have you been? He asked her.
Angelo is sick.
He feigned concern.
What's the matter?
A temperature.
I'm sorry. Poor boy, are they at your mother's place? He fixed her with an inquisitive look as he put the question, and Josie knew for sure that he knew very well that they had moved and that he was probing to see what she would say. She was prepared to call his bluff.
They are,
she said. Mendoza nodded solicitously.
I hope he feels better soon. If you need to leave early tonight, that's fine.
Thank you,
she said. She turned to go.
Wait, he said. Shut the door.
She found that her throat was dry. She did as he asked.
You were at the hotel last night.
It wasn't a question. It was a statement.
Yes,
she said carefully.
You saw the fire.
Yes. How did you know that, sir?
The fire department report mentioned your name. What were you doing there?
She remembered what he had told her about not pursuing the investigation. I was driving home, she said. I saw the smoke.
Really? It was just a coincidence.
Yes, sir.
But that doesn't make sense. It's not on your way home. You go south on the Skyway. The guest house is north. So don't lie to me. Why were you there?
She thought on her feet, finding the expression of concern that would be expected of someone who had just been accused of dishonesty by their boss.
I was seeing an informant, she said.
Really?
I met her in Intramuros.
Mendoza let the answer hang in the air and then smiled, almost as if he hadn't just accused her of dishonesty.
Just a coincidence, then?
Yes. I was passing.
Well, that's good. Because we talked about that case and how there was no point wasting time on it.
We did. And I understand.
Excellent!
You've been working long hours, Josie.
Don't stay late tonight. Go home to your boy.
The mention of Angelo made her flinch.
Thank you, sir. I will.
He needs his mother. You should spend more time with him. I appreciate your dedication,
But you're working too hard. And Manila is a dangerous place.
She knew exactly what that was. A threat.
Thank you.
She was barely halfway out the door when Mendoza said,
One more thing. Your informant?
Yes, sir.
Who is it?
She prayed that she could maintain her composure.
Her name is Fleur.
Get her details for me, please. Leave them on my desk before you go home.
What for? I want to speak to her.
Yes, sir.
She felt dizzy as she left the office. The bathroom was beyond her desk, and that was fortunate. She tried to look as nonchalant as she could as she headed to the door. But as soon as she was inside, and she was sure that she was alone, she locked herself in a cubicle, leaned over the toilet, and vomited.
Chapter 45.
Josie washed her face with cold water and then went back to her desk. She sat down and stared at her blank screen for 5 minutes. She needed to think, but it was as if her thoughts had been coated with Vaseline. She couldn't focus on anything for more than a few seconds. She kept thinking about Angelo, the car outside the house, and the bullet that had been slipped beneath the door. She knew that she should ignore the murder of Jessica Sanchez. She had been warned explicitly what would happen to her and her family if she kept putting her nose back into it. She thought again of the bullet and the photograph of Angelo and what Mendoza had said to her this morning. She thought of the owner of the bar and how his death was so obviously linked to whatever had happened to Smith. She thought of the fire. And, even though she knew it was folly, and that she would be putting herself and her family in danger if her disobedience was found out, she couldn't do as she was told. She picked up her phone and called the forensics department. She asked whether the autopsy had taken place on the body of Jessica Sanchez. She was connected to the pathologist.
"I took a look at her last night," he reported. "Cause of death was strangulation. Extensive bruising around the neck, as you would have seen. In addition to that, there was clear evidence of asphyxiation. Pinpoint hemorrhages in the skin and the conjunctiva of the eyes."
"What else?"
"Well, there isn't too much to report. It was very straightforward."
"Toxicology?"
"Nothing. What were you expecting?"
Josie made a leap. Had she been drinking? She heard the man tap on a keyboard.
8 milligrams of alcohol per 100 milliliters of blood.
That's hardly anything.
A single shot of spirit? Half a glass of wine?
She made a second jump.
"I sent in a specimen that we took from a suspect," she said. "John Smith. Could you check if that's been tested?"
"This isn't convenient, officer. I've got 2 autopsies to do this afternoon."
"Please? It would be very helpful."
The man sighed.
"Hold on."
There was a pause. Josie grabbed her car keys and left the building through the door that led out to the yard. She was in the parking lot when the man spoke again.
"We tested his blood this morning," he said, "and it was clean."
"No alcohol?"
"No," he said. "Not a drop."
The headquarters of Malate Fire Volunteer and Rescue was on Mabini Street. The squad's 2 tenders were parked at the curb, and their operations were managed from 2 huts on opposite sides of the street. Josie parked in a space between the 2 bright red fire trucks and approached the nearest building. It was painted white, blue, and orange, and there was a portrait of President Duterte stuck to the pane of glass in the door. Josie pushed it open and stepped inside.
"I'm looking for Andrada," she said.
"He's in back. Who are you?"
"Officer Hernandez. I met him last night."
"Stay there."
Josie waited while the officer went back into a room at the rear of the building. When he returned, the officer that Josie had spoken to last night was with him.
"Hello, officer," he said.
"You remember me, Chief?"
"Sure I do. You were at the Makabat fire last night. How can I help?"
"You got anything else on it?"
"On what caused it?"
She nodded.
We do. Come with me.
He took her through a door that led into a yard at the back of the building. There was a wooden lean-to built against the office. He collected a large jerry can inside a clear plastic evidence sack and put it on the ground at her feet.
We found that around the back of the office. It had gasoline inside it. Pretty obvious what happened. Someone poured it out as an accelerant and then torched the place.
He put the can back where he had found it and headed over to a vending machine next to the office door.
You want anything?
I'm fine, she said. He reached into his pocket for change and dropped some coins into the slot.
Are you investigating it?
He said as he collected a can of Coke. No, she said. Arson's not really my scene.
Not because of the arson, he said. Because of the bodies.
What bodies?
You don't know?
She shook her head. He popped the top of the can and took a long swig.
Okay, he said. Maybe the report hasn't been processed yet.
What bodies? She pressed.
The door to the office was locked when we tried it, so we broke it down. There were two bodies inside.
Josie swallowed hard. Male and female. He nodded.
We had forensics come over right away. A man and a woman, like you say. We couldn't tell shit, they were so badly burned up. But they were able to ID them from their teeth.
Oscar and Imelda Santos.
That's right, officer. The manager and his wife. They took them away and autopsied them. They'd both been shot in the head. So we're thinking it's obvious what happened. Someone kills them, locks the door, and sets the office on fire to burn the bodies.
Thank you, Chief, she said.
You need anything else?
No, she said. That's it. Josie drove back to the station and went back inside through the rear door. There was no sign of Mendoza, and as she glanced up the corridor, she saw that his door was closed. Where's the boss? She asked Dalisai.
Went out an hour ago, the officer said.
Josie's desk phone rang. She picked it up. Hernandez? It was Gloria out in the reception. Yes? You got a visitor? Josie hurried along the corridor and into the reception area. Gloria pointed to the old man waiting there for her. He was pacing back and forth. Hello, sir, Josie said. I'm Officer Hernandez. You wanted to see me?
I have a message for you.
I'm sorry, I don't know you, do I?
You don't. But you want the message or not?
The man was clearly uncomfortable in a police station. What is it?
My son, Hector, he is in Bilibid, and Hector knows another man there, Isco. And Isco says that he has a message for you from a prisoner he knows. This man is English. His name is Smith.
Josie turned. The only person she could see was Gloria, but she wasn't prepared to take chances. Come outside, please, she said. If the man found her suggestion odd, he did not say so. Instead, he followed her out into the broiling heat. What's your name, sir? She asked. He shook his head.
Doesn't matter, he said. You know Smith or you don't? Isco said you'd know who he was.
I know who he is. Go on.
Isco says Smith wants to see you. He says he has information you need. He says you need to go there as soon as you can.
When did he say this?
I don't know, lady. Hector called me this morning, said I had to say it was urgent. I'm just delivering the message.
Is there anything else? The man shook his head and then flinched as two officers ambled by them on their way into the station. Thank you, Josie said. The man shrugged and, without another word, turned and retreated quickly down the street. Chapter 46. Mendoza had told Josie to think about Angelo, so she took him up on the suggestion. She called the station and said that his sickness was worse and that she was going to take the rest of the day off so that she could stay with him. Without allowing herself the luxury of second-guessing herself, she got into her car and drove out of the city, heading south toward Bilibid once again. Smith was waiting for her in the visiting room, but it took her a moment to recognize him. His face was bruised much worse than it had been the first time she had been here to see him. His right eye was swollen almost completely shut. There were abrasions beneath both eyes and around his nose, and his top lip had been split. The right side of his jaw was inflamed as if he had lost teeth. She sat down opposite him. He gestured up to his face before she had a chance to speak.
"No," he said, the words mumbled around a swollen tongue. "I've made some excellent new friends."
"You look terrible."
"Felt better."
She looked around the room. It wasn't private. The guards at the door were eyeing the prisoners and their guests with sour watchfulness. Josie felt vulnerable. Mendoza was a powerful man with extensive connections, and she had no doubt that his reach extended from Manila all the way down to the prison. There was no guarantee that he wouldn't come to hear of her visit. She was taking a risk, yet she hadn't been able to resist it. She tried to put that out of her mind.
"You wanted to talk to me?"
"Yes," Smith said. "Thank you for coming."
"What is it?"
"I know what happened to me. The murder. I can explain it now. I know what happened."
She thought of the additional information that she had accumulated since she had seen Smith, the questions that she needed to have answered. She would wait, though, and see what he had to say.
"Go on."
"There was an inmate here. His name is Fitzroy de Lacy. He's English, very rich and very powerful. He made his money running guns. He was released yesterday."
"What does he have to do with you?"
"There are some things I haven't told you about me. I said I was on holiday."
"And you're not?"
"No. And my name isn't Smith."
"So, what is it?"
"Milton. John Milton."
"Why would you lie about that?"
"Because I don't travel under my own name. I made enemies during my career. People like de Lacy."
"Fine," she said. "I have driven 2 hours to get here, so I might as well indulge you. What did you used to do?"
"I was involved in the intelligence service."
"Like a spy?"
"That would be one way to describe it."
"You told me you were a cook."
"Would you have believed me if I said I was a spy?"
"I don't suppose I would."
He spread his hands.
"And you were involved with de Lacy?"
"In a fashion. He had a big organization. He did deals all around the world. I got into the business and found the evidence to shut him down. He was working on a deal with the communists in Manila."
Milton, Josie was about to think of him as Smith, but caught herself, shifted in his chair and looked at her, as if gauging her reaction.
"Let's say I buy all that," she said. "What does de Lacy have to do with you being here?"
"He blames me for what happened to him. He framed me. He orchestrated everything, and I fell for it. He knew that I knew Jessica. I don't know how he did it, but he arranged for her to contact me. I told you what she told me. She had a child, and she thought it was mine. I believed her. She told me to come out here, and I did. The night we met, de Lacy had her killed, and he made it look like I did it. I don't think I was drinking. It wouldn't have been like me, but I just couldn't remember."
"You weren't drinking," she said.
"How do you know that?"
"We tested your blood. There was no trace of alcohol in yours."
"And Jessica?"
"She had 1 or 2 drinks."
Milton's relief was evident, but it was quickly suppressed.
"The bottles in the hotel were left there to make it look like we had been drinking."
"That's a possibility."
He shook his head.
"It's more than that. That's exactly what happened. Whoever De Lacy got to do this made sure it looked that way. First, they drugged us. My money would be on flunitrazepam because of the memory loss. And then they killed her and set me up. You said the owner of the bar was shot.
The same night I saw him.
Maybe that's why. Maybe he had the drugs. Maybe he was a loose end. Or maybe you frightened him when you went to investigate. Or maybe you're going to see him frighten someone else. It's too much of a coincidence otherwise.
One of the guards cleared his throat. She looked over at him anxiously, but he was looking the other way.
There's something else, she said, leaning closer to him. I only found out this morning. The owners of the hotel where you were staying were killed last night. I went to see them, and the security footage was gone. Someone broke in and took the drive. And then I went back again, and the place was on fire. They were inside. They had been shot.
Someone's cleaning up behind themselves.
Everything about this is wrong. The bar, the hotel, and you being moved here, that shouldn't have happened.
You said your boss did that.
He did.
And then he's involved.
You think I don't know that? She hissed. I have been threatened too. There was a car outside my mother's apartment. They took a photo of my son coming out of school, put it in an envelope with a bullet, and pushed it under the door.
It was him.
He told me I needed to be careful. He is not subtle. I'm sure it's him.
I wouldn't be surprised if De Lacy has him on his payroll. You need to be careful.
She let her head hang.
This is getting out of control.
What are you going to do?
I have no idea.
I could help.
How are you going to do that, Milton? She hissed. You're in fucking prison.
Then get me out.
Yeah, sure. I'll just go and get the rope out of my car and throw it over the wall.
She clenched her fists and fought to control herself.
I don't know. Maybe I can dig into it. Maybe I could give you something to go to court with. You got a lawyer?
He shrugged.
A public defender.
Who is it?
Milton frowned as he tried to remember the name he had been given.
Garcia.
She groaned.
Great.
Not good?
Eddie Garcia is a drunk,
she said, before remembering that Milton was an alcoholic.
Sorry, I
forget it, he said, waving her embarrassment away.
And he's corrupt. That's worse.
I could give him evidence that says there's no way you were responsible and it'd make no difference. If this is a conspiracy, he'd just bury it. So, we have to think of another way.
Got any great ideas?
He placed both hands on the table and looked straight at her.
There is something.
What?
If I can get out of here, I'll be able to make progress that you can't make.
What does that mean?
The people we're dealing with, they don't play by the rules. That means we can't play by the rules either.
You say we? This isn't a team, Milton.
Dress it up however you like, but we share the same goal. I want to fix this, and when I do, I'll fix it for you too.
It doesn't matter what you say you can do. I can't get you out of here.
Not officially, but you can still help.
He looked around.
I told you before I need to get a message to a friend. He'd be able to help, but they won't give me a phone call. He doesn't know that I'm here. No one does.
You want me to contact him?
If you want to help me, that'll be the best way.
And assuming I did, what could he do?
Could you get him in here to see me?
Maybe, she shrugged. Probably. But what difference would it make? You'd still be here.
I was a soldier, Milton said. My friend was too. We have the same history, the same skills.
You're going to try to break out.
Unless you can do it another way.
What's the man's name?
Alex Hicks. Do you have a pen and paper?
No, she said, but have a good memory.
Milton recited a telephone number.
It's an English number, he said. Call him, tell him we've spoken,
Tell him he needs to fly out here as soon as he can. And he'll do that. Just like that.
Hicks owes me, and he's a good man. He'll come.
And then?
Bring him in here to see me so we can talk.
The clock ticked over to the hour and a buzzer sounded.
Time up!
One of the guards shouted.
All guests out! Now!
Josie tried to assert some order over the chaotic parade of thoughts that flashed through her mind. It was a mad flurry. The threats against her and Angelo, the murders at the hotel and the bar, Mendoza's complicity, Milton's untruths, and whether she could trust someone like him. She had always worked to lay down solid foundations upon which she could build for the future, and now, for the first time since her husband had left her and Angelo, it felt as if those foundations were unstable. Her options seemed limited. Milton had lied to her, but despite that, she couldn't get away from the conclusion that he was as invested in solving this mess as she was. It wasn't saying much, but he was the best that she had.
Josie? Milton said.
She stood.
I'll do it.
Chapter 47. Milton was taken back to the cell. He walked on, conscious of the guard behind him, and wondered whether Hernandez would follow through. He realized that he was relying on her. If she didn't deliver the message, there would be very little that he would be able to do. He knew that he stood no chance of winning his freedom at trial. She had made it very clear that the deck was stacked against him. He couldn't even say with certainty that he would make it as far as the trial. The beatings were taking it out of him. He was at Tiny's mercy. He would have to try to fashion his own escape, but despite subjecting the security arrangements to as detailed an assessment as his limited opportunities allowed, he had not discovered any serious weaknesses that he would be able to exploit on his own. He would have to ask Isco to tell him about the weakness that had been fortified, or push him to consider other weak spots that would be worthy of investigation. If worst came to worst, he would find a way to get over the wall, but, as Isco had made clear, even if he managed to get away, he would be an obvious target in an unfamiliar and hostile landscape. He would try, but the odds would be long. He needed help. First, though, he needed time. Isco was waiting for him. He was brushing his teeth with a toothbrush he kept in a cloth wash bag with a cake of old soap.
She came?
She did, he said. Thank you.
They came for you again, he said.
The four of them who work for the Lacey.
I'm sure they'll be back.
You can't carry on like this.
No, he said.
He looked at the toothbrush and had an idea. Could I borrow that? Wordlessly, Isco handed it over. Milton took it and held it in his hand, the brush in his palm. It was just long enough.
Can I borrow your lighter, too?
Milton rolled over so that he was facing the wall and, with Isco keeping watch, he took the lighter and thumbed flame. He used the fire to soften the plastic, waiting until it was blackened and soft. Once he was happy with it, he started to rub the edges back and forward against the abrasive surface of the concrete wall. He worked at it for an hour, turning the brush halfway through so that he could concentrate on the opposite side. He scrubbed, peeling away the plastic, and then heating it again so that it stayed soft. By the time he was done, he had rubbed away enough of the plastic so that the shaft ended in a point. Milton touched the end. It was sharp. It was a poor substitute for a metal shank, but it was the best he could do on short notice. The plastic was easy to grip. He would have liked some duct tape to roll around it so that he had something more substantial to grip onto, but he doubted that would be possible. He would make do with what he had. Chapter 48. The guards unlocked the cell doors in the afternoon so that the inmates could have their exercise. Milton took the sharpened toothbrush and slid it inside his trousers, the point prodding his thigh as he followed Isco down the stairs and out into the yard.
Be careful, the old man said, as they started to stroll around the same circuit as before.
Stay away from me, Milton warned. You don't want to get caught up in this.
I know what you're doing. It's dangerous.
I have to do something.
You said so yourself.
They might beat you in solitary, too.
They might. But Tiny is definitely going to keep working me over if I stay where I am. It's worth trying. What do I have to lose?
Milton tensed as he saw a group of four inmates walking out to intercept them. He reached down and plucked out the toothbrush, sliding it up his arm so that the handle was pressed against the inside of his wrist and the sharp point rested against his cupped fingers. The men wouldn't be able to see it until he wanted them to, and by then it would be too late for them.
Go on, Milton said. Keep walking.
Good luck, Smith.
Isco continued on. Milton stopped. The men were closing in. He recognized them. Two of them had been in the group that had attacked him the first day in the canteen, and the remaining pair had been part of the group who had beaten him in his cell before delivering him to De Lacy. Beyond them, Milton saw a pair of guards with shotguns waiting by the entrance to the exercise yard. There were another 10 guards scattered around the periphery of the space, and 2 watchtowers loomed at either end.
You, the nearest man said. You come with us.
Again?
Come.
Not today, lads. Tell Tiny I'll see him tomorrow.
We don't ask,
the man said. He took a pace ahead, stepping in front of Milton, less than an arm's length away.
We tell you. You come.
Milton dropped the shank into his hand and slashed out with it. He backhanded him with an upward diagonal, the point slicing through the man's cheek and continuing up across his eye and up his forehead. He shrieked with pain, his hands automatically flying up to his face. He wasn't a threat any longer. Milton ignored him and turned to the next man. Milton's arm was still raised from the first swipe, and he brought it back down and across in a forehand hack that found the side of the man's jaw and then tracked down across the soft flesh of his throat. It was a deep incision, and bright red arterial blood frothed out. The man fell to his knees as Milton pivoted. The third and fourth men were frozen to the spot, agog at the sudden detonation of brutal violence. Milton closed the distance to the nearest inmate with 2 quick steps and flashed the blade across his face. The man managed to raise his hands, and the point of the shank sliced across both outward-facing palms. The fourth man backed away. Then came the unmistakable boom as a shotgun was discharged. He heard the sound of a raised voice. He couldn't translate the Filipino, but the meaning was clear. He glanced to his right. One of the guards at the gate had fired into the air, and his partner was coming forward with his own shotgun aimed squarely at Milton. He dropped to his knees and raised his hands.
Lie down!
They bellowed. He did, covering his head with his arms. He heard the sound of the guard's boots in the sand as they ran across to him. He tensed, anticipating that he was going to take another beating. And they didn't disappoint him. They jammed the butts of their shotguns down onto his torso, working up his shoulders to his folded arms. He couldn't protect all of his head, and they jabbed down with the shotguns and struck him with kicks and punches, so many of them that he dimly assumed that others had come over to join in. He felt consciousness retreating and, once more, the familiar curtain of blackness twitched at the edges of his vision. The blackness grew pregnant and swollen and rushed over him, sweeping him away again. Chapter 49. Alex Hicks was having dinner with his family when his telephone rang. They were celebrating. The results of Rachel's last PET scan had been delivered that morning and, after another round of chemotherapy, the cancer was officially in remission. They had gone out to the Pizza Hut in the centre of Cambridge, and Hicks had somehow been cajoled by his boys to eat the hottest pizza on the menu.
They had conspired with the waiter to add extra chili to the topping, and, loath as he was to admit it, he was struggling. He grimaced as he started on the penultimate slice, aware that a light sheen of sweat had formed on his forehead. His sons found his discomfort hilarious, and Rachel smiled to see them so happy. It made Hicks happy too. It wasn't so long ago that the diagnosis had seemed like a death sentence. His phone was in the pocket of his jeans, and he felt it buzz for 15 seconds before it stopped. There was a pause, and then the phone buzzed again to indicate that a voicemail had been left. Not many people besides his family had his number, and it rarely rang. He finished the slice, exaggerating the heat of the chili for another cheap laugh, and then said he was going to the bathroom to run the cold tap directly into his mouth. He took an empty cubicle, shut the door, took out his phone, and navigated to his missed calls. He didn't recognise the number. It wasn't that it was unfamiliar to him, although that was true. He didn't even recognise the country code. He went to voicemail, set it to play the last message, and put it to his ear.
Hello?
Hicks didn't recognise the voice. It was a woman with an accent that he couldn't place.
This is a message for Mr. Hicks. Mr. Alex Hicks. My name is Josie Hernandez, and I'm calling from the Philippines on behalf of John Milton. He is in trouble, and he asked me to contact you. It is urgent. Please call me back.
The woman's English was halting, the accent heavy and difficult to decipher. She recited the same phone number that Hicks's phone had recorded and then ended the call. He stared at the screen for a moment as he absently wondered what to do. It didn't take long. He tapped the number and waited for the call to connect.
Hello?
You left a message for me?
Mr. Hicks?
Yes.
Thank you for returning my call.
You know Milton?
A little.
You said he was in trouble?
He has been arrested for murder. He is in prison waiting for his trial.
And what does that have to do with you?
I am a police officer in Manila. I arrested him, but now I do not believe he did what it is said that he did.
Hicks lowered the lid of the toilet and sat down. It was only thanks to the money that Milton had provided that he and Rachel had been able to fly to America for the experimental treatment that had saved her life. He had helped him with a small matter since then, but it did not extinguish the debt that he owed. Milton would not have called if it wasn't necessary. Hicks believed the woman. The fact that she had his number was evidence that Milton was involved and proof that he was in trouble.
I can't talk now, he said. Can I call you in an hour?
Yes, I will wait to speak to you. Please do not forget, it is urgent.
He ended the call and went back out to finish dinner. The kids had been waiting to see the new Avengers movie for a week, and he and Rachel had promised to take them. The boys were playing with their action figures in anticipation of the film.
Is everything all right?
Rachel asked him quietly.
I had a phone call, he said.
Alex, she said with a sigh, not now. We're having dinner.
It was about Milton. I think he's in trouble.
Rachel knew that Milton had provided the money that had funded the treatment. Her exasperation evaporated.
What kind of trouble?
The children were distracted, but Hicks kept his voice low.
He's in the Philippines. He's been arrested for murder. The call was from a policewoman. She said that Milton needs my help.
How?
I don't know. I said I'd call back this evening.
The Philippines? Are you going to have to go there?
I don't know. Maybe.
Rachel was patient, and she knew that they owed Milton everything.
If you have to, you have to. Are you going to miss the film?
I've got to call her back.
She nodded to their children. They'll be disappointed.
I know. She said it was urgent.
Don't worry, I'll take them. Just promise you'll keep me in the loop.
Of course, he said. He kissed her on the cheek, told his boys that he would take them to see the film for a second time, and then went to find a taxi to take him home. Chapter 50. Milton awoke. It felt as if he had been drugged. He could hear the sound of voices, but they were a distance away from him, and he was too groggy to understand them. He waited until he came round a little more. The voices were speaking in Filipino. Raucous laughter punctuated the conversations. He couldn't understand a word of what was being said. He was lying on a hard surface, no bedroll this time. His body ached and his head throbbed. He opened his eyes and wished that he hadn't. It seemed to trigger a fresh wave of pain, a surge that pulsed from his head and all the way up and down his body. He felt nauseous and weak. He was in a cell. It wasn't the one that he shared with Isco. There was no natural light, and as he tilted his head as far as he could without intensifying the pounding in his skull, he confirmed that there were no windows. The walls, floor, and ceiling were all fashioned from slabs of bare concrete. The only way in and out of the cell was a metal door with a blocked-off slit at head height. The light was from a single fixture overhead. Milton would have preferred it to be dark, but it was not. The light was bright and merciless. He was in solitary confinement. That, at least, was what he had banked upon. He remembered De Lacy's four stooges, ready to haul him out of the prison yard so that Tiny could beat him again. He knew that he had hurt three of them. It was possible that he might even have killed the man he had slashed across the throat. The guards had subdued him, beaten him until he was unconscious, and then brought him here. That was good. It was what he had wanted. He had been battered yet again, but he hoped that it would be more difficult for De Lacy to reach him here. He tried to work out what time it was, but that was impossible. He usually had an instinctive feel for day or night, but not now. He would make it a priority to find out the time. He had been kept in solitary before, and having a rough idea of the time was a crucial part of hanging on to sanity. The passing of hours and days was a constant around which he could balance out the loss of his liberty. He heard the sound of footsteps. He gingerly rolled over and tried to sit. His muscles had locked up, and the effort of raising himself up was excruciating. He pushed himself to a sitting position as the slot in the door scraped open.
"You are awake,"
a man's voice said.
"What time is it?"
"That is unimportant. You will stay here now."
"Where am I?"
The man didn't answer.
"You killed another inmate. Killed one and badly hurt two others. You will be kept here for your own safety until you can be tried. After that..."
The man let the words peter out.
"Well,"
he began again,
"after that, you will return to the main prison, and I doubt you will last very long. But we must keep you safe until your sentence is passed."
"Water," Milton said. "I need a drink."
"Later."
The slide scraped back again, and Milton heard the footsteps retreating. It was progress, he told himself. It was what he had wanted. So why didn't he feel any more optimistic? Part 3. Chapter 51. Hicks pushed up the blind and looked out of the porthole window. The 747 was on its final approach, and he could see the lush green canopy of trees as they descended over a forest and then the sprawl of metropolitan Manila ahead. He had purchased a ticket to the Philippines last night. He knew that Rachel was not pleased to see him go, but he explained that he couldn't ignore Milton, and she had told him that she understood. He had been a soldier for many years, and during that time there had been months that he had been forced to spend away from his family. They had hoped that those days were behind them, but this was something that could not be ignored. Hicks told her that he expected that this would be only a brief absence. she told him to hurry home. He had driven to Heathrow and caught the overnight Philippine Airlines flight. It was scheduled to take just under 14 hours, and he had watched a film with his dinner and then slept. He watched through the window as the jet descended. There was a seemingly long moment as the jumbo slowly navigated the final few feet to the ground, the hangars rushing by in a blur, and then the wheels bumped and the rubber squealed and the reverse thrusters roared to slow the plane down. Hicks looked out at the terminal, bathed in a brilliant, bright afternoon sunlight that promised a hot day, and found himself wondering what his stay would bring. Hicks made his way through immigration into the arrivals hall. He had arranged to meet the woman here, but as he looked into the sea of expectant faces, he realised that he had no idea what she looked like. He had her cell phone number and was about to call it when he noticed a young woman working her way to the barrier. She was holding a piece of paper with his name scrawled across it. He raised his hand and, as she acknowledged him, they both set off to meet at the end of the barrier. "Mr. Hicks," the woman said. She was wearing a police uniform, a dark blue skirt with a lighter blue shirt. The shirt was decorated with the badge of the Manila Metropolitan Police. There was rank insignia on the shoulder, a ribbon above her right breast that noted her citations, and a nameplate that identified her as Officer Hernandez. She wore a pistol belt with a holstered Glock.
"That's me," he said.
"I'm Hernandez," she said.
"Nice to meet you."
"How was your flight?"
"Long."
She led the way out of the terminal building. The early afternoon heat washed over him. "Hot, yes?"
"You could say that."
"It'll get hotter. I'm afraid the air conditioning in my car doesn't work very well either, and we have a long drive ahead of us." She led the way across the road to a multi-story parking lot.
"Where are we going?"
Hicks asked her. "To prison," she said. "We need to see your friend." Chapter 52. Hernandez drove them to the south. Her car was a bit of a wreck. The transmission sounded as if it was on its last legs, and the air conditioning was shot. The footwell was littered with trash, empty cans and paper coffee cups, newspapers, empty sandwich wrappers, and fast food packaging, a plastic carrier bag. Hicks swept it aside with his foot. "Sorry about that," she said, nodding down at the detritus.
"How long have you been in the police?"
he asked. "Long enough."
"How is it?"
She shrugged. "It was better before."
"Before what?"
"The president. There's a lot of violence now that wasn't here before. A lot of mess for us to clear up." They had spoken on the telephone for 15 minutes yesterday, but now she took the opportunity to take him through everything that had happened to Milton since he had arrived in Manila. She explained what she had found at the hotel room on the morning before Independence Day and the process by which she had peeled away the layers of lies and deceit until she was convinced that Milton had been framed.
"You didn't say why he agreed to come out here," Hicks said.
"The woman said that he was the father of her son." Hicks had never heard Milton speak of children before.
"And is he?"
"I don't know." They cleared the city, and she was able to pick up speed. "How do you know him?" she asked.
"What has he told you?"
"That he worked in intelligence, and that he was a soldier before then, and that you have a similar background." To a point, Hicks thought. Milton was the reason that he had not gone into intelligence. He had refused his transfer to Group 15 because he saw something that he believed made him unsuitable for the role. It turned out that Milton had been right about that. "Well?" she asked.
"I was a soldier," Hicks said, "for a long time. I got out and I found myself in trouble. Milton helped me."
"That's why you came. You owe him."
"Yes," Hicks said. "I do."
It took 2 hours to drive to Bilibid. Hicks looked through the windshield at the building ahead of them. It was oddly ostentatious for a prison, with a facade that looked like a castle with two towers and crenellations across the top of the structure that looked like battlements. A tall flagpole, easily 100 feet high, held aloft a Filipino flag that draped limply in the feeble breeze. A sprinkler chugged rhythmically back and forth across the wide patch of lawn between the parking lot and the entrance.
"That's a strange building," he said.
"That part is old. The prison is behind it. It's new. They built it a few years ago."
"It's secure?"
"Yes," she said.
"So what do we do now? How are you going to get me inside?"
"I'll come in with you. I'll say you're from the British Embassy and that you need to speak to him."
"Why would I come to the local police to do that? Wouldn't I just come down on my own?"
"They won't ask questions. The guards are lazy." Iron gates rolled shut behind them, restricting their access to the road by which they had arrived.
"If they do?"
Hicks asked. "They won't. Trust me." Hicks got out of the car. Josie followed him. "I'll go first," she said, "and let me do the talking."
"Understood."
They crossed the lawn and followed a neat path that led to the main entrance. There were two guards at the open doors, leaning against the wall with cigarettes in their mouths. They glanced up at Josie and then Hicks, and then resumed their conversation. Hicks followed Josie inside. It was cooler here, the shelter of the thick stone walls providing pleasant relief from the strength of the sun outside the door. Hicks saw an office with a plexiglass window dividing it from the lobby. There was a short corridor ahead of them, and then another lobby that was equipped with two X-ray machines and an airport-style metal-detecting archway. The guards might be lazy, he thought, but it wasn't going to be easy to bring anything into the facility. Josie made her way to the plexiglass window and spoke through a grill to the clerk behind it. Hicks waited a few paces behind her. He watched the comings and goings in the lobby. Uniformed guards passed through on their way to or from the interior of the facility, all of them armed with pistols that they wore holstered on their belts. Clerks and officials crossed the space, using the doors on either side to, Hicks guessed, make their way to their offices. He saw a blaze of bright light from the second lobby with the security equipment. A pair of double doors had been opened, and he caught a quick glimpse of the courtyard beyond. "This way, please," Josie said to him.
"Is everything all right?"
He saw satisfaction in her eyes. "Yes, sir," she said. "Mr. Smith is going to be brought to the visitor's room. We'll see him there." Chapter 53. The visiting room was functional. It was the communal space where the inmates were brought to meet with their visitors. Hicks would have preferred somewhere private, but they would have to make do with what they had been given. He was grateful that he had been able to make it this far without his cover story being questioned. Officer Hernandez had accompanied him to the room and then taken a chair in the waiting area. Hicks said that he would collect her when he had finished with Milton and then they would leave together. He glanced around the room at the other inmates. They were male, tough, and bore the bleakness of their situations across dead-eyed and expressionless faces. Many of them had prison ink on their exposed skin, their arms, legs, and faces decorated with crude tattoos. The inmates were distinguished by their orange shirts. Their visitors, for the most part, were dressed poorly, their tired and mismatched clothing suggesting that they, and the men they had come to visit, originated from the poorest strata of Filipino society. Hicks remembered the gleaming new airport and the skyscrapers of upscale Manila that he had seen as he and Hernandez had driven south, and knew that a place like this would have collected the dregs. Hicks looked at his watch. He had been here for 10 minutes. He turned to the door, wondering whether he should go and speak to Josie, when the main set of double doors on the north wall opened and a man was brought inside. He was marked out as an inmate by the same uniform as the others, and Hicks almost disregarded him. His face was bruised and marked by cuts that had been clotted with dried blood. One eye had been forced shut by a socket that was swollen and blackened. He walked with a limp, hunched over with an arm pressed to his side as if to protect damaged ribs. Hicks looked away, and then, as he noticed that the newcomer was coming across to his table, he looked again. He hadn't recognized him. It was Milton.
"Jesus," he said.
Milton nodded and lowered himself gingerly down onto the hard wooden seat.
"Thanks for coming," he said. "Can we speak safely?" "They don't listen in," Milton said. "We're lucky. If this was a room to ourselves, they'd bug it. I don't think they care here so much."
He stretched out his shoulders, exhaling painfully from the effort.
"How do I look?" "Terrible. I've felt better. I've been roughed up every day since I've been here." "You got my message then? She called me last night. And you came right away."
Hicks nodded.
"I flew overnight." "I bet your wife was pleased about that." "We owe you, Milton. She knows."
"You don't owe me anything." Hicks waved that away.
"We'll have to agree to disagree on that."
"Well, thank you. I appreciate it."
"What's happened to you? You mean, how did I end up here?"
Hicks nodded. "I was tricked." He told Hicks his version of the story, how he had been approached in London, how he had been told that he was a father and that the mother of his child wanted to see him. He explained how he had been framed so that he could be brought here to be tortured by a man from his past with a grudge to bear. "They're clever," Milton said when he was finished. "They knew me. They knew exactly which buttons to press. I've been alone for a long while, and that's fine. I don't want sympathy. It's my choice. But when someone says that you have kin... a son..." He paused. "I let it blind me. I should have been more careful, and now, because I wasn't..." He paused again. "She's dead, and here I am."
"This man, who is he?"
"Fitzroy de Lacy. He's an arms dealer. I was responsible for him being convicted. He was here for 10 years.
"Was here?"
"He got out 2 days ago."
"I don't know how. The regime changed. Maybe it's more friendly to him. Maybe he's offered to work with them. But he's had help from the police.
I should be in a holding facility in Manila, not down here. Hernandez said that her boss arranged the transfer, and then she was threatened and thinks it was him, so I think we can assume that he's involved." Milton glanced meaningfully at Hicks. He waited until the guard who had approached their table from behind had continued upon his way.
"You're not going to be able to take many more beatings like that," Hicks said.
"I know," Milton said. "But I think I've bought myself a little time. I put some of De Lacy's goons in the infirmary when they came for me yesterday. They said I killed one of them. They've put me in solitary until they can work out what to do with me."
"And when they put you back in circulation again?"
"I'm hoping you might have been able to get me out by then." Hicks sucked his teeth.
"That won't be easy," he said. "The guards aren't anything special, but the building looks secure."
"I agree. You're going to need help."
"You got any ideas?"
"Actually, I do. I have someone in mind, a man I worked with when I was in the group."
"One man? This isn't a two-man job, Milton."
"I know, but he's brilliant." He hesitated. "Well, he's eccentric, but he's also brilliant."
"At what?"
"Computers. I think this will be right up his street."
"What's his name?"
"Ziggy Penn."
"Never heard of him," Hicks said.
"No reason why you would. He's a bit of a hermit."
"It's your funeral. Where do I find him?"
"The last I heard, he was in Korea, but he'll have moved on now. He doesn't stay in one place long."